Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The insurgency in Iraq reached a bloody benchmark today with the successful detonation of two bombs inside the Green Zone, killing at least 10 people, including four Americans. The attack struck at the heart of the American presence in Iraq. The massively fortified Green Zone in Baghdad houses thousands of Iraqis, including the interim government. It houses the U.S. Embassy and many Americans. Until today, it was considered perhaps the safest place in Iraq. Now, no place in Iraq appears safe. Bombings, kidnappings, and beheadings have left even journalists trapped by fear and very real danger. Among them, Wall Street Journal reporter Farnaz Fasihi, the 31-year-old American-born daughter of Iranian parents who grew up in Oregon, went to Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism in New York, proved her mettle in Egypt, in Afghanistan, then went to cover Iraq. 2 weeks ago, a private email she sent to friends was published on the web. Her very personal candor there about the chaos in Iraq has turned heads around the world. Tonight, we'll hear a reading of that email and talk with correspondents hunkered down in Baghdad about covering a war so dangerous that news coverage itself is becoming a casualty. Tonight on Point, the press, the mayhem, and the public's need to know in Iraq. In a moment, I'll be joined by three of Farnaz Fasihi's fellow reporters in Baghdad. But first, let's hear part one of her now famous email to friends, read by On Point producer Meghna Chakrabarty.
Being a foreign correspondent in Baghdad these days is like being under virtual house arrest. Forget about the reasons that lured me to this job, a chance to see the world, explore the exotic, meet new people in faraway lands, discover their ways and tell stories that could make a difference. Little by little, day by day, being based in Iraq has defied all those reasons. I am housebound. I leave when I have a very good reason to and a scheduled interview. I avoid going to people's homes and never walk in the streets. I can't go grocery shopping anymore, can't eat in restaurants, can't strike a conversation with strangers, can't look for stories, can't drive in anything but a full armored car, can't go to scenes of breaking news stories, can't be stuck in traffic, can't speak English outside, can't take a road trip, can't say I'm an American, can't linger at checkpoints, can't be curious about what people are saying, doing, feeling, and can't. There has been one too many close calls, including a car bomb so near our house that it blew out all the windows. So now my most pressing concern every day is not to write a kick-ass story, but to stay alive and make sure our Iraqi employees stay alive. In Baghdad, I am a security personnel first, a reporter second. It's hard to pinpoint when the turning point exactly began. Was it April, when Fallujah fell out of the grasp of the Americans? Was it when Muqtada and Jish Mahdi declared war on the U.S. military? Was it when Sadr City, home to 10% of Iraqi's population, became a nightly battlefield for the Americans? Or was it when the insurgency began spreading from isolated pockets in the Sunni triangle to include most of Iraq? Despite President Bush's rosy assessments, Iraq remains a disaster. If under Saddam it was a potential threat, under the Americans it has been transformed to imminent and active threat, a foreign policy failure bound to haunt the United States for decades to come. Iraqis like to call this mess the situation. When asked, "How are things?" they reply, "The situation is very bad." What they mean by situation is this. The Iraqi government doesn't control most Iraqi cities. There are several car bombs going off each day around the country, killing and injuring scores of innocent people. The country's roads are becoming impassable and littered by hundreds of landmines and explosive devices aimed to kill American soldiers. There are assassinations, kidnappings, and beheadings. The situation, basically, means a raging, barbaric guerrilla war. In 4 days, 110 people died and over 300 got injured in Baghdad alone. The numbers are so shocking that the Ministry of Health, which was attempting an exercise of public transparency by releasing the numbers, has now stopped disclosing them. Insurgents now attack Americans 87 times a day. A friend drove through the Shiite slum of Sadr City yesterday. He said young men were openly placing improvised explosive devices into the ground. They melt a shallow hole in the asphalt, dig the explosive, cover it with dirt, and put an old tire or a plastic can over it to signal to the locals this is booby-trapped. He said on the main roads of Sadr City, there were a dozen landmines per every 10 yards. His car snaked and swirled to avoid driving over them. Behind the walls sits an angry Iraqi, ready to detonate them as soon as an American convoy gets near. This is in Shiite land, the population that was supposed to love America for liberating Iraq.
That was a reading of the first part of an email sent to a friend by Wall Street Journal reporter Farnaz Fasihi on September 29th. Joining me now from Baghdad is Carl Vick, correspondent for The Washington Post, Thanasi Kambanis, correspondent for The Boston Globe, and Michael Ware, correspondent for Time magazine. Good evening to all three of you. Thanks very much for joining us. Carl Vick, if I may go to you first. We're hearing a very private communication that's become very public from Farnaz Fasihi. It captures a lot of what we've heard from you and from other correspondents over the months, but it did it in this private, public way that's really caught people's attention. How do you feel about your ability, the ability of the press corps in general today, to practice journalism in Iraq?
Well, we feel confounded. I mean, all of us do. It's immensely frustrating. You hear it in Farnaz's words there. And, you know, we have come to this stage somewhat abruptly, both abruptly and, you know, gradually. The security situation has, you know, declined steadily over the course of the occupation and the return to sovereignty. And today we had these explosions in the Green Zone. And, you know, that was one of the few places where we thought we could go and work. I guess not.
And, of course, that so heavily protected, famously surrounded by all kinds of concertina wire and troops, layer upon layer. And even there, Michael Ware, today, as we've all heard, bombings and death and body parts, the same kind of picture inside the Green Zone we've seen now so many times outside the Green Zone.
Absolutely. The last garrison has been breached. But don't forget, it was breached 9 or 10 days ago. They found an improvised explosive device hidden inside the Green Zone near one of the cafes that were targeted today. And I can tell you, the insurgents, particularly the Islamic extremists led by Abu Musab Zarqawi, are targeting the Green Zone. They're targeting foreigners. Journalist has no meaning. I received a document from them recently that says civilian is no longer in our vocabulary. So the gloves are off. And what this shows is that the Iraqi government and the might of the U.S. military has very limited control. Essentially, U.S. soldiers can confidently control only the ground upon which their boots stand. That's the state in Iraq. Try being a journalist here.
Thanasi Kambanis, we're going to hear later in this hour from Rod Norland of Newsweek magazine. Newsweek, we're told, has at least temporarily pulled its staff out of Iraq. He'll be speaking to us from Amman. They'll be going in future, we're told, only as embedded reporters with U.S. military personnel. What's your sense, Thanasi, of who's there and who's not? Is the number of journalists declining out of fear of personal harm?
When we do get out and look around, we see fewer and fewer of our colleagues every day. Earlier this week, we all gathered when a colleague had been kidnapped for a few days. And when I looked around the room and saw what was left of the printed broadcast media in Baghdad, it was surprising. We all fit in the living room at the Time magazine house.
And Michael Ware, give us a sense of the kind of incidents that are sending journalists out of the country, that are leaving journalists writing desperate emails like Farnaz's. What's happened with correspondents? Give us a sense.
Well, I mean, apart from the general risks faced by all Iraqis and all U.S. soldiers here of indirect fire from mortars lobbing on you from nowhere with little to no warning, to car bombs exploding anywhere or everywhere. We're on target for another record month for suicide car bombings. And then, of course, there's indiscriminate shootings. I personally, was detained ever so briefly by Zarqawi's people. That was here in the center of Baghdad in a in a suburb that is within mortar range and rocket range of the US embassy. We had a US photographer snatched from his car on a Baghdad street. We have Italian NGOs being taken from their houses. We have two Americans and a Brit, again, taken from their houses. That's how difficult it is. I've been in Fallujah several times whilst it's been under insurgent control. Despite my contacts with the insurgents, do I go to Fallujah now? No. Anything short of the express permission of the allegedly Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist leader of Abu Musab Zarqawi, and I can't go to Fallujah. The jihadis have got a stranglehold on this war, and they see no distinction between us and U.S. soldiers.
Carl Vick with The Washington Post, let me ask you, and we're going to hear the balance of Farnaz Fasihi's private email, now very public, in a few minutes. But let me ask you how correspondents have responded to the publicizing of those private thoughts of hers, which are clearly shared by many of you. Is it on balance a good thing? Has it opened this issue up in a more public way, made the world aware of the circumstances under which you're working? Is that helpful?
It's not helpful to Farnaz, who's sort of, you know, stuck hanging out there with a private communication. It's true to her experience, and it's true to our experience, but it's not every Iraqi's experience. And it just seems to have answered some real appetite for basically plain talk. We all write news stories with the appearance of fairness and balance and all these elements. But, you know, the Internet is a private, it has a whole different vernacular and assumption. I have in front of me, actually, at this moment, an email that came out of the Green Zone today, and it says something about differences in perception. This came from, I don't know, someone who works in security, private security, or maybe for the Department of Defense. It was written to someone at my newspaper who forwarded to us for information. I won't give the name.
Yeah.
But it says, it begins with, Zarqawi's team hit us big time. No way these were rockets or mortars. They had to be car bombs, and they were close. Massive explosion ripped through the air. My ears popped. The building's foundation shivered. Who knows how many people are dead. It is bad. This is the worst attack against the U.S. presence in Baghdad, ever. Five people died. This is why they call it the Green Zone. It's not an everyday occurrence, but it's not an unusual one out here in what they call the Red Zone. What you hear in our voices is what you don't hear in newspaper stories, which is a human reaction to that and the stress and the frustration of it.
And clearly a shaken email coming out of the Green Zone. We hear it in Farnaz's email. We hear it from each of you today. Tanasi, what's your sense of how this ultimately affects how the world understands what's going on in Iraq? Will we get to the place where we just won't know because correspondents just can't tell us?
Well, I think that's a very real fear. I mean, that was a few weeks ago when I felt quite comfortable hopping in the car and going and talking to Mahdi Army fighters in broad daylight or the late evening. That's off limits to me now. I think we look around and see the zone in Baghdad alone where we feel comfortable traveling shrinking increasingly. And me and lots of our colleagues are relying on reports of local stringers, on phone conversations with eyewitnesses or even secondhand eyewitnesses.
And Michael Ware, let me put to you, is this ultimately about foreign correspondence in Iraq, or is this a story of Iraq's continuing descent into chaos primarily?
This is about the deterioration. I sat with a very, very senior Iraqi intelligence official last week, and I said to him, you must be happy. There's success in Samarra, there's success in other U.S. operations, the momentum seems to be picking up. He leant back in his chair, sighed, opened his hands and said to me, we are losing. Now, that's not an opinion shared by his American intelligence counterparts, but he said to me, I'm a very senior intelligence official. I can't travel in Haifa Street. I can't travel in Yusufia. I can't go to Qarada. I can't go to Abu Ghraib. These are all parts of Baghdad. Now, what does that tell us? I mean, we're seeing American operations underway now, offensives. But the question is, are they attacks? Or are they counterattacks? Are we on the defensive? I mean, they symbolically struck at the heart of U.S. power here in Iraq. This is not the Saigon embassy during the Tet Offensive being overrun temporarily by suicide fighters. But Zarqawi, if that's who it is, and he has claimed responsibility, is sending a very clear message to us
Michael
that
Ware
we control nothing.
Michael Ware with Time Magazine, Carl Vick with The Washington Post, Tanasi Kambanis with The Boston Globe. Please stand by. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will hear more from Farnaz Farsihi's email, that is The Wall Street Journal reporter, and talk more with our correspondents in Baghdad. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the press and the mayhem in Iraq. I want to play for you, read again by our On Point producer, Meghna Chakrabarty, the balance of the private email from Wall Street Journal reporter Farnaz Farsihi that came out into the public domain and has been so widely distributed on the email as an insight into what's going on in the lives of working journalists there, the inside thoughts of one journalist as she looked out on the situation in Iraq.
For journalists, the significant turning point came with the wave of abduction and kidnappings. Only 2 weeks ago, we felt safe around Baghdad because foreigners were being abducted on the roads and highways between towns. Then came a frantic phone call from a journalist female friend at 11 p.m. telling me two Italian women had been abducted from their homes in broad daylight. Then the two Americans, who got beheaded this week, and the Brit, were abducted from their homes in a residential neighborhood. They were supplying the entire block with round-the-clock electricity from their generator to win friends. The abductors grabbed one of them at 6 a.m. when he came out to switch on the generator. His beheaded body was thrown back near the neighborhood. The insurgency, we are told, is rampant, with no signs of calming down. If anything, it is growing stronger, organized, and more sophisticated every day. The various elements within it, Baathists, criminals, nationalists, and Al-Qaeda, are cooperating and coordinating. I went to an emergency meeting for foreign correspondents with the military and embassy to discuss the kidnappings. We were somberly told our fate would largely depend on where we were in the kidnapping chain once it was determined we were missing. Here's how it goes. Criminal gangs grab you and sell you up to the Baathists in Fallujah, who will in turn sell you to Al-Qaeda. In turn, cash and weapons flow the other way, from Al-Qaeda to the Baathists to the criminals. My friend Georges, the French journalist snatched on the road to Najaf, has been missing for a month, with no word on release or whether he is still alive. America's hope for a quick exit? The Iraqi police and National Guard units we are spending billions of dollars to train. The cops are being murdered by the dozens every day, over 700 to date, and the insurgents are infiltrating their ranks. The problem is so serious that the U.S. military has allocated $6 million to buy out 30,000 cops they just trained to get rid of them quietly. As for reconstruction, firstly, it's so unsafe for foreigners to operate that almost all projects have come to a halt. After 2 years, of the $18 billion Congress appropriated for Iraq reconstruction, only about $1 billion or so has been spent, and a chunk of that has now been reallocated for improving security, a sign of just how bad things are going here. Oil dreams? Insurgents disrupt oil flow routinely as a result of sabotage, and oil prices have hit a record high of $49 a barrel. Who did this war exactly benefit? Was it worth it? Are we safer because Saddam is holed up and Al-Qaeda is running around in Iraq? Iraqis say that thanks to America, they got freedom in exchange for insecurity. Guess what? They say they'd take security over freedom any day, even if it means having a dictator ruler. I heard an educated Iraqi say today that if Saddam Hussein were allowed to run for elections, he would get the majority of the vote. This is truly sad. Then I went to see an Iraqi scholar this week to talk to him about elections here. He has been trying to educate the public on the importance of voting. He said, President Bush wanted to turn Iraq into a democracy that would be an example for the Middle East. Forget about democracy. Forget about being a model for the region. We have to salvage Iraq before all is lost. One could argue that Iraq is already lost beyond salvation. For those of us on the ground, it's hard to imagine what, if anything, could salvage it from its violent downward spiral. The genie of terrorism, chaos, and mayhem has been unleashed onto this country as a result of American mistakes, and it can't be put back into a bottle. The Iraqi government is talking about having elections in 3 months, while half of the country remains a no-go zone, out of the hands of the government and Americans, and out of the reach of journalists. In the other half, the disenchanted population is too terrified to show up at polling stations. The Sunnis have already said they'd boycott elections, leaving the stage open for a polarized government of Kurds and Shiites that will not be deemed as legitimate and will most certainly lead to civil war. I asked a 28-year-old engineer if he and his family would participate in the Iraqi elections, since it was the first time Iraqis would, to some degree, elect a leadership. His response summed it all. Go and vote and risk being blown into pieces or followed by the insurgents and murdered for cooperating with the Americans? For what? To practice democracy? Are you joking?
And that was the conclusion of a private email sent on September 29th by Wall Street Journal reporter Farnaz Fasihi to a handful of friends. It has now been spread right around the world. There's nothing private about it anymore. I'm with Carl Vick of The Washington Post, Michael Ware of Time Magazine, and Thanasi Kambanis joining us from Baghdad tonight. Here, again, she's talking about how dangerous it is in Iraq, and she's making some pretty strong personal views known there to her friends, presumed in private as well. And Carl Vick, let me ask you, is the view of the conflict, the dark view of Iraq's prospects expressed here in Farnaz Fasihi's email, is it widely shared among the press corps in Baghdad?
Well, it has to be. I mean, we're hunkered down. If Mick Ware can't, well, I don't know anyone besides Mick who would be going to Fallujah, but if he, who's essentially fearless, just calculates that he won't come back from a reporting trip, if none of us can do the essential reporting here that is talking to Iraqis, moving out around in society, understanding, trying to gauge to what extent insurgents are supported, move with explicit permission of the population, or are simply feared and therefore allowed to operate. This is absolutely the crux of what's happening. It's something that's very elusive, and you cannot count on a stringer to an Iraqi national to go out and be able to communicate to you so you can write. It's confounding. We've got a little bit of a tunnel vision because of the restrictions on our movements.
And Thanasi Kambanis with the Boston Globe, let me ask you, here in a correspondence to her friends, private correspondence, Farnaz Fasihi, he's editorializing pretty strongly. The Wall Street Journal editor Paul Steiger defended her on this. He said it's a few expressions of purely personal opinion in a private correspondence. She's on vacation now. The Wall Street Journal has said she can go back to Iraq if she'd like to. We don't know if she will. But what do you think of this expression of personal opinion here? Is it what other reporters think? And if it is, why isn't it being more forthrightly expressed in news stories? Are reporters constrained by the traditions of the news story from saying what they really think?
I mean, Tom, we've already spoken about the frustration of the news format of communicating a really visceral sense of what it's like here. But as far as making an argument for whether the Iraqi experiment is a failure success, do I view my role as being able to write a story that passes judgment on the administration per se? Not at all. Do I see my role as being able to check claims that are being made here and compare them with the reality on the ground? Yes, I do. And when I can't do that, I feel like I've been cut off at the legs. Today is a sort of case in point. After these explosions in the Green Zone, the military issued a statement using her sort of Orwellian term for insurgents that said anti-Iraqi forces are trying to create the perception of instability in Iraq. Now, that's the sort of thing that I think galls all of us as reporters because we want very much to be on the ground showing exactly what instability is taking place and what violence there is on the streets and let the readers judge if that's a perception of reality. But I think we want to be close to the experience of both the U.S. soldiers here and the Iraqi citizens who are suffering under increasing lawlessness and risk every day.
Michael Ware, let me put the same question to you, because it's very much on American minds. Central to the presidential campaign this year is the issue of whether the Bush administration has the country on essentially the right track in Iraq, and it's hard work, as President Bush says, but we have to stay the course, or whether there's a significant course correction required. Do you think that Americans are getting a complete enough picture of what's going on there to decide?
Oh, I have to speak for the press corps in general. We're feeding it to the American people. There is nothing in Fanaz's email that almost all of us haven't written. Zarqawi's terrorists control part of Baghdad in sight of U.S. forces. The Iraqi government is a hollow shell, unable to exercise any authority. There are terrorist safe havens, Al-Qaeda-linked safe houses, bomb-making facilities, organizations that exist here in Iraq now, that did not exist a year ago and did not exist under Saddam. By invading this country, the U.S. administration has given birth to, has fostered the very terrorist threat that they said they came here to prevent. Jihadis now come here to prove themselves, and we're now seeing that exported within the region. Is that a success? We're getting no traction here. We're losing the population, and Alawi's government is unable to move themselves. So what are we left with?
Carl Vick, let me ask you, if you could, just to explain how reporting actually gets done. You and Tanasi Michael have all mentioned stringers. Farnaz Fasihi says she can't leave her room. She's under house arrest, in effect. When we read reports in the Washington Post or the Boston Globe or Time Magazine, what's the process that's gone into producing this news?
Well, when a car bomb goes off now, well, first of all, I don't go out to cover it because often the crowd around it will be maybe blaming the Americans, and if they identify me as an American, it can get ugly and I can be in danger. So we send a translator or a stringer, somebody who's basic, understands the basic, has worked with us, knows how to report and what kind of details and things to get. But I tell them not to go for an hour because they've been doing 1-2 car bombs. You know, the 34 children who were killed in Baghdad a couple weeks ago, a lot of them were killed by the second bomb that was driven into the ambulances and crowds around there. They come back, I'm rewriting. I often give them a byline because, hell, it's their work. Sometimes they work in areas where they can't be identified in print. I mean, sometimes it would be dangerous to give them a byline. That's it. I mean, I can go to the green zone. I can make appointments and go from point to point and with someone I trust on each end of the line, the straight line I drive. That's my life. Other reporters are more adventurous, but that's basically what we're doing here at the Washington Post these days.
And you, Carl Vick, and other American correspondents, you're in a private home or one of these two hotels that we hear about. Where do you hole up?
Well, we're in one of the hotels. We're about to move to a private home near another one. But yeah, you got to be living behind glass walls. Yeah, for sure.
Tanasi Kambanis, what could you do 6 months ago that you cannot do today in Iraq?
How about what could we do 1 month ago? I mean, we used to be able to drive to Najaf. We used to be able to drive to cities in the north and the west. I think up through April, we used to drive to Fallujah for the day whenever interesting things would happen there. The first thing to go was the western province after the uprising in April. And since August, really driving south out of Baghdad or north out of Baghdad has become an almost illogical risk because of not just insurgents, but the bandits will kidnap you for money or kill you for the car you're in. In the last few weeks, the final constriction has been the fear of really doing any sort of snooping around within inside Baghdad. It's one thing to go to an appointment, but to just drive around looking for a story in Sadr City, in Qadamiyah, and any of the neighborhoods we used to frequent because of the heightened risk of kidnapping, that too has begun to seem like a ridiculous risk. We all joke about ending up on television in an orange jumpsuit, but lately, the last few weeks, we've stopped making even that black humor joke because it seems far too real.
And Michael Ware, of course, covering wars, guerrilla wars, has always been dangerous. American correspondents and many others took considerable risks in the Vietnam War. What measures do you refer to figure out what's the appropriate level of risk to take? Clearly, some risk comes with the job. How do you decide when is it too much? What's the historical measure that you look to, if you do it all?
Well, I don't think there's too much historical precedent for this nature of warfare for journalists. I mean, journalists have always been in the firing line in one form or another. But here, we're now seeing increasingly we're specifically targeted. There's not even a vague sense of neutrality for us anymore. We're seen as a Western interest that, according to Zarqawi's people, who I talk to, we are legitimate to take and literally behead. So they're looking for us. We're a prized asset. Some differences in the way I operate. I used to travel out to the insurgent strongholds to meet their commanders. I'd be under their blanket of protection and travel to Fallujah or other safe havens. Now, I can't do that because Zarqawi's people may risk taking me. So what do? These commanders come to Baghdad to see me. I meet them inside Baghdad. That's how free they feel now. But when I'm traveling to them, to somewhere in Baghdad, I can't travel without one of their insurgent representatives in the car because I can literally be snatched from my vehicle. And that's what happened to me with Zarqawi's people. If I didn't have one of his representatives in the car, I was dead. Nonetheless, these guys are confident enough to come and see me here in Baghdad, the center of American power. What's that telling us?
That's a pretty incredible fact. Carl Vick, let me ask you, you and others have pointed out what journalists don't know these days, how much is not known about exactly what's going on and who's fighting in Iraq. In the green zone today, of course, bombs going off right in the heart of the American headquarters there. What about American forces, the American military? Do you have the sense that it knows what's going on, or is it also hunkered down and suffering from some lack of intelligence?
They are not. They're hunkered in places. They project power when they patrol, but they're making discrete decisions whether to patrol or not, because basically they sow instability everywhere they go. They're a target. The bombs go off next to the road when they pass by. Otherwise, that road is okay for Iraqis. So I can't speak to how good of eyes they have, but they tend to rely on, you know, what they're hearing from their translators, their own translators, who have to live with them, are not in the community very much because they're dead men if they try to live at home, and what sort of people who are friendly to them tell them. When I was in Najaf, they had pretty decent intelligence against the Sadr forces, but it was a town that was friendly to a different Ayatollah, to Sistani. So, you know, people don't speak terribly frankly to a man with a gun in his hand, and that's what American forces are, so I don't think they know a lot more than we do. They probably are just sharper at processing it in a tactical way.
And Carl, in brief, what do you think the impact will be, the effect of this bombing inside the Green Zone today on American operations, on American morale?
Well, I mean, from what I saw that email I read earlier, they finally gotten a taste of what it's like in the Red Zone. I mean, I think it's going to really hurt morale and shake everyone up.
I am very grateful to all three of you for joining us from Baghdad this evening. It's great to get it direct from you. Carl Vick with The Washington Post, Michael Ware with Time Magazine, and Thanasi Kambanis, thanks to each of you for being with us tonight. Wonderful to have you on. Good luck.
Thanks
so
much.
Thanks,
no problem.
Take care.
Three correspondents giving it to us straight from Baghdad tonight. All of this prompted. Of course, there's been a lot of news reporting, but then there came the personal email of Wall Street Journal reporter Farnaz Fasihi. You can read the full text of Wall Street Journal reporter Fasihi's email and learn more about Farnaz at our website, onpointradio.org. It's just click something open here. Questions for you when we come back. If reporters are locked down by danger, how will we learn what's going on in Iraq? And what do you make of the private email, now very public, of Wall Street Journal reporter Farnaz Farsihi? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the press, the mayhem in Iraq, and the public's need to know. We've been talking with reporters from Baghdad about the danger and difficulty they face in covering the war. Earlier, we heard the entire text of a private email, now very public, written by Wall Street Journal reporter Farnaz Fasihi about her perceptions of what's going on, about how locked down, housebound, fearful, and we heard the foreboding in that email. You can join this conversation tonight. What happens to our perception of what's going on in Iraq when journalists have a hard time leaving their hotel rooms, their bunkers, in effect? Without reporters as eyes and ears, can we have an informed opinion about the Iraq war? And what about Farnaz Fasihi's private email made public? Does that get your attention? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. There's more to learn tonight. We are joined now from Amman, Jordan, by Rod Nordland. He's correspondent at large for Newsweek magazine. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner. He's covered war zones all over the world, including the war in Iraq. Rod Nordland, thanks for being with us at this very ungodly hour in Amman, Jordan. Thanks a lot for being here.
No problem.
Also joining us tonight from New York is Jay Rosen, chairman of the Department of Journalism at New York University. He's a press critic and writer whose primary focus is the media's role in a democracy. He's author of the book, What Are Journalists For?, and writes a blog at pressthink.org. Jay Rosen, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Rod Nordland, first to you, and give us the latest on Newsweek. If we've got this right, you are no longer based as an operation in Iraq. You're going to only be going in from outside, embedded with U.S. troops. Is that correct? And if so, why have you taken this step?
Well, that's correct. I mean, it's a temporary situation. We pulled out of it a little over a week ago. We still have people inside Iraq embedded with the military, and we're going to use, for the time being at least, using Amman, Jordan, as a base to send people in on embeds. It's basically because we assessed that the situation had gotten to the point where we just could not protect American staff inside of Iraq any longer. Sooner or later, we felt somebody would be either kidnapped or killed.
Rod Nordland, you are nobody's babe in the woods. You've done great reporting from Bosnia and Afghanistan and Chechnya, incredibly dangerous places. Does it strike you as kind of astounding that one of the major news weeklies in the United States can no longer even base its reporters inside Iraq? What should we take from that?
Well, it's bad. It's really bad. And, you know, it continually surprises me the degree to which Americans, even my friends and family, seem to be at least partly persuaded by the administration's relentlessly sunny take on how things are going in Iraq. Things are very bad. I mean, I've been there for most of a year and a half, more than a year and a half now, and I don't think it's ever been as bad as it is now. The thing that, for those of us working in Iraq, that surprised us about the reaction to Farnaz's email was that anybody was in the slightest bit surprised. But I think that shows you just how difficult it's been for us to really succeed in getting across to people how bad things.
Jay Rosen in New York, please jump in here with us. This conversation tonight has just got my ears burning at a couple of levels. First of all, how can we make decisions about this presidential election when we have news magazines who can't even be based in Iraq anymore? And secondly, what about this private email? Why did we have to wait for this to somehow break things open? All our correspondents tonight say, we keep reporting this, but it doesn't get heard. What's going on here with the message and the news coming out of Iraq that the Farnaz Fasihi email has shed light on?
Well, one thing that's happening is that the administration has another story, another picture, and it keeps saying so almost relentlessly, and not only saying it, but kind of acting as if things are going well. And no matter how much we are aware of modern propaganda techniques, of spin, of differing assessments of complex situations, we still somehow find a discordant picture, a chaotic picture, because we're being told different things. And the news is a counterweight to that. However, the news media itself has to now persuade us that it's a reliable narrator. And there are a lot of people in the domestic political scene who are undermining, discrediting the news media at the same time that it's struggling to tell us what's really going on in Iraq. And the Bush administration itself has a kind of a press doctrine in which attacking the press is a normal thing to do. And so this is part of the reason why the email became so shocking. It was obviously a person talking to us, not a system, not a news system. And that is part of what was responsible for the reaction to it. And I myself was one of those people. I wrote about it myself.
Mm-hmm. Rod Nordland, do you feel, when you have reported from Iraq, do you feel some kind of political or contextual constraint on the picture that you paint? Do you find yourself balancing it against a story painted in Washington that may not be accurate? And have you felt that taking the edge off of your reporting? Do you agree that that somehow emerges here?
No, not at all. And my editors are not going to ask me to impose some kind of phony balance on the reporting. We're going to report what we see and the way things are. Now, what happens is actually much more pernicious in this administration. What they've been doing is a concerted campaign of taking their message around the major media. They call it going around the filter. And in fact, in one speech, Bush actually explicitly referred to it. We're going to go to you around the filter and take the picture, their story directly to the American people. And they do this in a number of ways. One way, for instance, is to plant stories with local affiliates for television stations and feed them pieces that are already kind of canned, or feed them access to officials, even in Baghdad by video link and so forth, and certainly in the U.S. And they have done this on aggressively and in such a thoroughgoing way that I think it's had a very successful impact on shaping people's attitude. I mean, I was back in the States a little over a week ago just for a funeral for a couple of days, and I was astonished. It was actually the day that Farnaz's email became public and talking about it. And I was just astonished that even surprised any, because we've been reporting that same kind of thing, you know, week in and week out.
And yet we read it there in a private email, and it can really shake people. I want to invite our callers into this conversation. It's so great to have both of you tonight. David is calling from Boston. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you all for covering this story. My comment is just that I think it's strange that this woman's email was private and has kind of the real story in it. And I thought, when I heard the subject, isn't this a journalist who's, you know, in Iraq to cover the story? Why is it not just going into her journalistic reporting? Why is it this extra special format in order to get the truth out? And kind of you all covered that in what you were saying. And I guess I just want to thank you for being here covering it and say that I'm scared at the idea that someday the story could be not taking place. And thank you. I guess I'll just continue listening.
David, we've got it. I think it's still a live question and a good one. Jay Rosen, you've written on this subject. Let me go to you on this. Rod Nordland and all of our correspondents that we've had on tonight, and our admiration for them is terrific. They all say, we've written this again and again, yet Rod's home for a funeral, and he talks to his friends and family, and he feels like they don't understand what's going on in Iraq. You've said there's some problem here with the way this is coming across. Rod says it's because the administration is telling a different story. They're going around the media. But you've indicated, I guess is the right word, that somehow you see that the mainstream press as in some way ensnared or even complicit. Don't let me put the wrong word on it. Describe it yourself. What do you see happening?
Well, I think it's a very complicated situation where the reporters say we've been saying this, and they have. And the Americans who read the email say, wow, all of a sudden that puts it into perspective for me. And the White House is saying neither of those things. And I think it has something to do not with the information in the email. That was readily available, and it was reported many different times in different ways, and I knew everything pretty much in that email. It was something with the terms of address. The way that she was addressing people was, look, I'm just a human being trying to get by, and here is what I see. I cannot help but draw these conclusions. I didn't want it to be this way, but this is the way it is. Don't let anyone fool you. Here is the situation. I heard it and I believed it. Or you know what they say? Well, some of that is true. And it's the tone of voice where a person is leveling with you almost beneath the news, at a level of truth that we know rumbles underneath the news. And it's primarily an effect of language and tone. And somehow that sense of speaking the truth as a witness has been filtered out of journalism by various defensive moves journalists now have to make in order to persuade us that they're not on the take.
Not on the take from whom?
Well, from a whole host of critics who are out there flinging their ammunition all the time across the political spectrum, but through a series of mistakes and scandals and screw-ups.
But I want to be sure I understand when you say not on the take. You don't mean that literally money-wise, but you mean that they're covering their hind ends against some kind of criticism or political attack? And what kind?
Well, that they are biased, that they want the mission to fail, that they are embedded in they're telling the story of the troops, or that they are a mouthpiece for the government, or that they're a mouthpiece for the terrorists, or one of dozens of charges that they face. And not only that, but a climate in politics where the news media is increasingly being incorporated into a very divisive election campaign, as with the Dan Rather case and the Sinclair Broadcasting case right now.
And pulled into that polarity. I want to get another call here. Tom is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
These are my concerns. If the information in the email from a reporter for a very prominent national newspaper is correct, then don't we have to have doubts about the veracity of what the administration is telling us about this war? But even more central to this, isn't the real problem is that the credibility of the journalistic community, the journalism community, is at stake here, because they're not bringing this story into the mainstream media. And this is what the inability to report is as big a story as anything about the war.
Tom, we've got it, and our time is short, but it's a great question. Rod Nordlund, you must be just chewing on your early morning fingers there, because, you know, you've been working to report this and reporting this, and yet you can hear this since you saw it yourself when you came home. People don't get it. What is the press's responsibility for that lack of comprehension here?
Well, I mean, when this email came out, I switched the phone out, actually, and we were both laughing because both of us have done stories very, very similar to the content of her email. Just the format was different. They were done as stories. And even, I mean, I've done, I think maybe she has as well, a first-person story that was written in my own voice about how bad things are. I mean, I think I've talked on your show about how bad things are.
Yes.
And it's not that we're not telling it. These people just aren't getting it. To some extent, people aren't listening to it. There's a lot of that as well. As much as it's a major issue in the presidential election, you know, there still seems to be a real kind of attention deficit in America. People just don't want to hear how bad it is. They don't listen. I think that, you know, this email kind of struck a chord. Partly it struck a chord because people saw a kind of whiff of conspiracy in there. Oh, this is the truth that the media has been suppressing. And partly because Farnaz works for the Wall Street Journal, which is a kind of famously conservative newspaper, at least on its editorial pages. And people all assume, well, she would have been telling this if she had only been allowed to. Well, in fact, she was telling this in her newspaper in various ways. She's a good journalist. She's been reporting this. And when it comes to its news columns, the Wall Street Journal does pull its punches. And
Rod, we've just got 1 minute left. If I may put this to you, Rod, you've now based Newsweek outside Iraq. That clearly is not such a great way to cover, ideally. Are we in danger of just losing track of what's going on there, of not having the eyes and ears on the ground to tell us?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we very much hope this is a temporary situation. We'll find a way to resolve it. But in the meantime, we'll have people embedded with the military. What we're in danger of losing is the Iraqi voice. You know, it's getting harder and harder for us to talk to Iraq, find out their side of the story. And seeing it just from a military embed perspective is going to make it that much harder. I don't think it's going to make it impossible, but it's going to make it.
It has been an absolutely fascinating evening. Rod Nordlund with Newsweek magazine in Amman, Jordan. Thank you so much for being there and for all your reporting. Jay Rosen in New York, we really appreciate your perspective tonight, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Jay Rosen is chairman of the Department of Journalism at New York University, author of What Are Journalists For? You can read more about Farnaz Fasihi and her now-famous email about reporting from Iraq on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.